Thank you very much. So we will kick off on time as well as we can. So thanks to those in the room and those online who are listening in for joining the concurrent session that is being presented by Bojang on reinsurance for the greater good. If you do have questions during the presentation, it is helpful if you send those through before the end so we can transition seamlessly to that. There's a lot of content to get through, so we'll get going quickly. As a buyer for Bopo, he joined Swiss Re in 2023 as the head of public sector solutions for the Australian and New Zealand market. He has over 15 years of experience working in the reinsurance industry across underwriting, broking and analytics, servicing clients from Australia, New Zealand, Southeast Asia and Greater China. Bo is a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia and a fellow of ANZIF. He has a Master's of Commerce in Actuarial Studies from Macquarie University, as well as an Executive MBA from the Australian Graduate School of Management at the University of New South Wales. So welcome you to the stand, Bo, and I will get out of your way.
Thanks, Adrian. Good morning. There's a lot of seats on the front. It's not a lot of audience. If you want to come to the front, that's fine. If not, I try to speak up. I do like to walk around, but it doesn't seem the stage will allow me to. Now, how do I start this? So, we see guys in here. Here we go. So
quickly, really today we're going to talk about three things. Try to be close to this. Three things I want to talk about. One is give everybody an update on what's happening in the insurance, reinsurance market. Many of you might work in that market. Many of you may not. The second part is about talking about some of the unique challenges in the public sector. And finally, I would like to talk about this, my personal concept of reinsurance for the greater good. Now, let's go ahead. So what's happening in the reinsurance market? For those who are not in the P&C reinsurance market, I'll just quickly run through what reinsurance insurance means. The way I see it, it's, first of all, it's a cost, right? And it's commonly regarded as a cost. And this is not talking about just the insurance company, but also a lot of corporate, a lot of government entities. That's their primary concern is a budget. But sometimes these days it's becoming a luxury because capacity is not always available, price is not always attainable. But if you're going through the actuarial channels and pathway, you start to think about this. It's indeed a type of risk transfer. You transfer away a piece of risk for a price, and you get covered when there's volatility coming in. Then, in that school of thought, is also a way of financing. It's a form of capital. But if you're stepping back and look at your holistic way of managing balance sheet, it's also a way to managing your balance sheet from a holistic point of view to make sure that you're not only managing the asset side of things, but also the liability. But also, insurance and reinsurance is a form, when you're stepping out of the world of insurance company, reinsurance company, retrocessions, it's for a lot of corporate individuals and governments, it's also only a small part of the overall risk management, which I will touch on later on. So you have to think about the insurance and reinsurance in the context of risk acceptance, mitigations, avoidance, sometimes talk about that, adaptations as well. Now, what are we talking about in all of these? So we started by looking at the global capital market, which is a big fish, and then there's a flow of capital through investment and providing coverage and then pay losses to retrocessionaries. So these are the companies that reinsure the reinsurers. And then you retrocessionaries provide this capital support, a flow of capital to reinsurers and to play. And the reinsurers, in turn, provide capital to the insurers. And in return, there's a flow of return in the form of premium or adjustment premium sometimes. Indeed, what I'm trying to show here, it is a capital market. It's a part of the broader capital market.
It's a small, very small part of the capital market. So in 2016, I made a presentation. I'll be quick on the slides. I said the traditional reinsurance, there's a death of the traditional reinsurance in 2024. Now, it didn't happen. But I think if you have a pessimistic view of the market, that it could happen, because you look at from 2016, we have unprecedented large severe claims in a more frequent way globally. We went through an unknown pandemic for 4 years out of those period. The CPIs, the inflations are high globally. If you're just looking in Australia, and I went to a session discussing about inflation, someone says insurance is the only industry, is one of the only industry, few industries, actually have its own line and the CPI reporting. When they're separating, you know, you have alcohol and tobacco, housing and health inflations, insurance inflation has its own figure and is at the top of everyone else. At the same time, you know, we talk about the flow of capital. You know, you look at the amount of capital available in the market in the form of traditional reinsurance. It reduced in 2022. It bounced back in 2023, but is nowhere near where the trajectory of the capital growing in the past. And reinsurance companies collectively has not really made money until 2022, and that's why you have a huge market correction when people start to push up retentions, structures, and price increases. And it's only until 2022, 2023, the reinsurance market start to make money on the underwriting basis, on the return on capital basis, sorry. So what it is? So a simple way to summarize the state of the market, I would say, let's have a look at price, because we talk about it is a cost. So a lot of people's mind, in government's mind, essentially, it is cost. So we have a really soft market in 2017, relatively speaking, and then it sort of goes back up, and through COVID, now we're sort of at the top since 2006. And yet, 2024, it seems to be the one where we knew it seems flat again. So the question is, is this a temporary plateau, or is it going to revert it back down, like where it was? Or is it going to keep going? We're taking a breath for everyone to readjust, and then we keep going. It remains to be questionable. So putting all this context in the public sector setting, right, this is one of the studies we did for 2023 protection gaps, and that's probably the hottest topic everyone talk about. On the left-hand side, top two numbers talk about the total economic loss that happened in 2023. In the middle columns talk about the insured losses. And as you can see, the protection gap is still growing. You know, on 2023, the protection gap globally, the net cat globally and man-made, is $155 billion. In 2023, it's $174. It increased and is about the 10-year average. So it's not getting smaller, it's getting bigger. What about in Australia? If you look at the Australia protection gap in Australia, these are the top five events that have the huge by protection gap. This is not the top five event by size or by insured or economic size, it's by protection gap. So Lismore, for example, is one of the standout, right? It's one of the biggest events. It's part of that flood. We just had an inquiry about affordability. And yet you look at the protection gap coming out of that, 45% of the losses are uninsured. So insurance market obviously have this challenge. But if you look at it from an economic point of view, a lot of the either business, government, individuals are not insured. As actuaries, we like to put things in a graph. If you look at the graph, I know there's five dots. I'm not going to get into a scientific discussion about credibilities and how whether you can draw a line of it, but anecdotally, you look at this, say, the bigger the event, the bigger the protection gap, which then bears the question, what do we really need catastrophe insurance for? For the large ones, for the smaller ones, for the medium ones, is there any other way we can close this gap? And there's some school of thought in saying, well, should there even be a gap? Should the gap be zero? Or should the gap be X%? So this is a very busy slide. I'm not going to go read everything on it, but what I want to highlight is government have a very different thinking than corporate and insurance companies. And government, we're trying to narrow it down to five categories, but I really you can put them in different categories as you wish. The one that I want to highlight specifically on this page is this: two out of these five categories, namely economic, environmental, geopolitical, social, and technological, two out of these are somewhat permanent. They're here and they're not going to go away. Environmental and social, there's going to be a constant challenge. Where geopolitical, you may say, depends on where, depends on when. Economic, there's through cycles. Technology is always advancing. People catch up. So really, it's a matter of how do we deal with some of the challenge in the public sector space about environmental and social development. Now, what that transpires into day-to-day and on the action or what you can observe level is you got these two factors pulling governments away. One is you have increased costs. You know, emergency response is getting costly, and there's a loads of public infrastructures that are uninsured. If you look across the New Zealand, the New Zealand Infrastructure Commission published a report, 80 billion of New Zealand infrastructures are uninsured. Many of them are critical infrastructures. The cost of replacements are high. And then you also have this uninsured householders. How do you support them? How do you make that part of your policy and making sure society has a stable still operation? On the other hand, you know, that's the cost on the cost side of things, and the income side of things. The tax incomes are lower, and you're always going to have an issue. There's the myth about why does even government want to buy insurance or reinsurance? The cost does not matter because we can always raise tax, and which is true. But there's a question about when and how much you can raise tax and how long it would take. But also, there's a deep down question about intergeneration equity. Is you raise tax of what generation to pay for the actions of the which generation. So, there's also all the other challenges you see on the last slide. The COVID, we have a dip in the tourism income. We have issues with the export revenue due to geopolitical. The financial market instability in the financial market means you probably have a lot of issue with investment returns. If you look at a lot of the government entities, especially when it comes to bodily injury classes, they have huge reserve and huge investment, which constitute a large part of their operating income. So these two parts, together with what we're having at the moment, the production gap, we're having a real problem. We need to close them. And there's not a one person, one institution, or even a one government job. I think it's that everyone needs to work in every different directions, trying to think more broadly. And one of the thinking processes about resilience. So if you look at this, a chart comparison, again, there's a lot of numbers in here. I'm not going to go into every one of them, but you look at Australia. In APAC, we're not bad. We're very resilient in a way that we just ahead of New Zealand. But you look at insurance penetration, we're only about 20, 25%, 30% New Zealand, ANZ, whereas UK is 100%. Switzerland is 55, and then Canada and America are much, much higher in terms of insurance penetration. So how do we make insurance being part of the resilience and help to improve the overall resilience of the society, doing the greater good? That is something that I think we need to look at and investigate. And I'm going to land this section about the challenge in government onto these slides. And I did have the copyright on the bottom, so just in case anyone's is wondering. This is a game called SimCity. I'm not sure anyone comes across it, but there's many versions of it. Now it's on SimCity Mobile. You can play on your laptop. You play on the laptop, now you can play on your tablets. All right. So it's a game that you can just go in and create a world and attract people to live in, generate income, and build all those fancy buildings and stuff, which takes a lot of planning, in a sense. If you want to play this game, you're going to be very good at strategic planning, where to build, where to do things, and be ready for random catastrophe happening in the game. But if things doesn't go well, you guess what? You can press the button and restart, and easy. Right? We're not in SimCity. We probably should, in the mindset of SimCity, and have a bit of planning, but we're not. And we certainly can't just wipe it out and say, let's forgot about this suburb and wipe it out and relocate everybody elsewhere and adapt that way. It takes time. You know, it takes time to plan. There are certain areas of the risk we didn't plan well, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't be starting planning now. And it takes time. So it's a collective approach. We need to take planning seriously into the whole adaptation conversation. So finally, this is probably the more practical day to day for insurance and reinsurance contact is, what do we mean by greater good? You know, in my line of work, talking about public sector solutions, is to talk to government and public agencies about what are the tools and levers you can use to turn things around. And if you haven't been planning, let's plan now. If you haven't been having the idea about or money or funding for adaptation, let's think about now how you're going to get there. It's ultimately, when it comes to insurance solutions, it's a part of the capital market. It is finance. You need to pay a margin at a point to take away some of the volatilities. And there's many things of them. Insurance is only part of it. So where does insurance sit? I sort of alluded to, you talk about, this is the slide I'm about to present in the risk management function conference, is talk about the risk management cycle, which is not dissimilar to our actuarial control cycle or control cycle in general, right? Is you go and you start a blank paper, you identify the risks you have, and obviously you have the unknown, right? So, and then you analyze it. So governments sometimes don't operate like insurance companies, where you have a lot of geospatial. They're definitely moving towards more maturity in terms of data analytics and thinking process about risk-based risk management. But they're still not quite at the same sophistication level in terms when it comes to geospatials and understanding the perils, the vulnerabilities. But they're starting to. Right, and then once you've gone through that, then you're going to make a decision. And the decision is not to say our insurance premium is $100 last year, can we do it for $90 this year? Right, or even can we do it for $100? The question is about what part of my risk exposure is critical, which part of them is my day-to-day, which part of is the one that I can't really bear, I should share, and I should transfer. And that decision-making will lead to the action part, right? And then insurance is only a small part of it. You know, I was having these conversations about some of the New Zealand's local councils. They say, oh, our insurance price is going up very high. Our biggest trouble is the local park benches and public toilets. And that's how we really worry about we're not getting insurance for that. It costs for those getting high. And the question is, do we really need insurance for park benches? Like, I know you always had it for 25 years, but if times are tough, maybe it's time to think about different actions. And then once we did that, it comes to the typical control cycle mentality, right? You're going to review it. You're going to monitor and review how things are going. That's when adaptation comes in. That's when mitigation comes in. And you can continue with the cycle. The other thing that, like, coming from a private sector into this public sector practice is that you realize the concept of risk appetite has not been articulated the way as many of the insurance companies in Australia have been. And the concept of risk return is not there, it's a cost. It's not financing, it's not capital, it's just a cost. They don't really think about it in the context of the insurance management statement. There's no such thing, and there's no capital management framework, because sometimes you have conversations, they say, well, we don't have a capital issue, we have a funding issue, without realizing they're just different terminologies in the same context of risk transfer. The risk appetite statement part conversation is also interesting when there's a difference between risk appetite and risk tolerance, and sometimes that's not clearly articulated, where you say, I don't have the appetite for that, but if it really happened, I can probably bear with it. That's a continuing education process. Now, many of you, it's a very busy slide. If you're interested in any of these, let me know. I can share more. I don't want to bore you with all of them, but what I want to demonstrate this page is there has been a lot of government, a lot of solutions available for government risk and government challenges. And obviously, not all governments are the same. Some are rich, some are poor. And in this instance, you do involve other institutions like the World Bank, the Asia Development Bank, they come in to finance some of the risk transfers. But end of the day, there are solutions available. There are public-private partnerships needed. And it's happening globally, not so much in Australia because we somewhat falls into the developed country. But at certain public sector risk transfer, you may call that developed country still developing in certain areas. Now, I have a whole stack of case studies, which I'm not going to go and read the details, but I want to highlight a few sort of key thinking process when you're trying to look at what risks can be covered and how we can cover them. You know, one of them is coral reef. So we did we had a case study about Mexico hurricane coral reef, which is the first one of its kind in 2018, when it's the first of its kind when it comes to protecting natural resource or heritage. So it's in the form of a parametric cover. It established in 2018, and it was sponsored by the regional government. Similarly, we have seen case studies about, is it made the news, the Chile earthquake. So they bought a parametric cover with the Chilean government. And what I want to highlight is, if you look at this, $630 million in the scheme of things is not a lot of money. It's really not a lot of money in the context of Chilean government and the potential vulnerabilities. However, it is the first step that when the government's coming out and saying, look, we're willing to find a solution for something rather uninsurable in a way, to at least have a way to finance the post-disaster release and emergency responses. So there's also other covers, and when you think about innovations, you go, okay, we're not actually, if your insurance is the instrument in the broader capital market, then that can also be linked as a derivative product to say, if there's a natural event, how do we then pay certain financing, or how do we financing the opportunity cost or the cost to substitute what you have already have. So therefore, there's a parametric solutions on, and when a drought happened, then the payouts are linked to the cost of energy. Then you can, that cost of energy, be able to keep the farmers operating and so it's to provide them stability now from an operational point of view. So it's not indemnity based, right? It's not really there to replace, but it's there to reposition. And that's a very important concept for me is, when people buy insurance, sometimes they think about, I buy insurance when something bad happened, I got a replacement of what I have. But in certain cases, you may ask the question, do I really want a replacement, or I just want the opportunity to reposition myself so I can get on with my life, right? And earthquake is one of these. There's those examples when, you know, you have a building, you have $3 million building insured in here, and earthquake happened. You sum insured the $3 million plus all the other stuff, and then the question is, if there's really a catastrophic earthquake, there's liquid convictions, then you may not be able to rebuild in that place for a long time, and you may not want to rebuild in that place at all. So in that case, do you really need $3 million, or do you need something different to help you to find another side and go on with your life? Because it's an actuary summit, I don't want to leave out the life and health colleagues. I'm not sure there's any life and health colleagues in here. You know, it's when they call it, one of the challenging issues for governments in general, especially with aging populations, is longevity risk. I mean, it's fantastic of all the medical improvements, and we're all living longer and enjoying a better life. And, you know, these days, 40, 50, 60 is still called middle age, right? But there are consequences about how long we're going to work and financing our retirement, and a lot of the governments having pensions. In Australia, you know, government we have a pension system. Australia has been branded as one of the best pension system. I think when superannuation was first designed, where we have the combination of government pension, compulsory superannuation, or defined benefit at the time, plus personal saving. And the three-pillar approach has been named by the World Bank being an innovative, a leading practice of how to finance retirement. But then, yet, with people's aging, with accumulation funds now, a lot of them now coming to the end of accumulating phase and getting the retirement phase, there will be problems, and people live longer, and how do we finance them? So We have done the transactions like longevity swaps in Singapore to helping with that part of the cohort of population growing. The longevity swap is not a new concept. It's been around. It's very popular in the UK, but not so much in Australia. But it can be extended into other areas when, for example, there was a recent discussion about Mexico, when there's a lower socioeconomic class, when they don't have a lot of savings, but they do also have longevity risks. So how does government provide certain fundings while not completely drawn out of their balance sheets with uncapped liability going forward? Last but not least, we talk about capital market. I do want to touch on the topic of cat bond because people say they are discussions about cat bond. They're not here for Australia and New Zealand because regulator doesn't want you to buy it, or it's too complicated, and or most of the time there's basis risk and has to be in domicile basis risk from a coverage and the currency point of view. What I want to say is not necessarily the case. There's a cat bond in the ANZ last year. EQC, all of this is public information, by the way. EQC placed the cat bond in the market, and its domicile in New Zealand dollar is not a big number, to be honest. I think it's about 250 million New Zealand dollar, which transpires into US dollars and a lot. But its domicile in New Zealand dollar, it's indemnity based, and is provided an alternative source of capital. It's not an alternative solution. It's an alternative capital solution to the traditional capital for the New Zealand government. And it's a viable solution for the public sectors because a lot of public entities have the function to raise debt. And people look, there are people speaking with, they're thinking about raising a green bond and the like. But at the same time, if you need billions of dollars coverage and realistically asking how much of that capacity you need, it's coming from insurance, it's available for insurance market, given that sometimes the price works, sometimes it doesn't. How do you diversify your source of capital or source of financing? Cat bond will be a viable solution. But the caveat is, it's not for anyone. Also, disclaimer, I'm not a licensed dealer, so I'm not selling you a financial advice. So this is general market discussions. I think that's the end of my presentation. I really want to leave some time for questions. And the takeaway is really, the insurance reinsurance market is still going through a quite volatile phase, and I think there's a light at the end of the tunnel, but no one knows whether it's an oncoming train. The government have its unique challenge, and it really the protection gap is widening, but it really requires public and private sector collaborations and corporations to solve some of these challenges. And there are some case studies, but it's not the details that I want to show you. Is the fact that I want to say there are solutions. The key is to plan. And that will be the end of my presentation. Thank you. Questions, please.
Happy for you to stay there, but you may. First question is quite specific and relates to one of the early slides, but yep. It's a question asking you to clarify the 100% present penetration rate in the UK. That observation that sounds high, and I guess first question is on clarifying that. There'll be a second question.
Okay. So the penetration, and I'm not going to pretend I know everything about how that was calculated. To be honest, it's coming from Swiss Re Institute. But I think the penetration specifically refers to people wanting to get insurance and get insurance. Right? So it's in that sense, when you link that to the protection gap in our context, there's a lot of instances when people want to get insurance, they can't get insurance. So that is my view of seeing the UK, because when you look at the penetration and insurability, I tend to put a lens about the Maslow's need triangle, right? When you add the bottom of the need triangle, you don't have a lot of assets, you probably don't need to buy insurance because you don't have nothing to insure for, right? But then as you're progressing more wealthy and then you things start to build out and then your assets to accumulate, then there's a phase you start thinking about, okay, this is quite precious, how do I insure it, how much it costs me, right? And that's when things comes in about when talking about penetration, how much is insured, not insured, protection gap. But then at certain level and certain things, when you're on the top of the Maslow triangle, you say, look, I'm actually quite rich. There's things I don't need to insure, I can bear it myself, right? If you So no one's really going to go down and insure their notebook, like in terms of paper, pen papers, right? You can replace it quite easily, but everyone wants to insure, you know, their watches, their home and content. You know, watches are very expensive these days. Apple Watch, $500, $600 each. But realistically speaking, like some of them you can probably replace, some of them you can't. But that's why, that's how I see it. I'm not sure that answers the question, but I've tried.
I think it answers the first part. So I think following on from that, I guess following on from penetration rates leads into the question about protection gaps.
Yeah.
So, and we do see in both cases a lot of variation across countries. And so the question there is, how do you think about what is a reasonable protection gap? Is there such a thing as a reasonable protection gap or a reasonable penetration rate? And what problems do you see arising when they're either very high or very low?
Yeah. So I want to take this opportunity to make it a bit of interactive, right? So who thinks the protection gap should be zero in this room? And who thinks this protection gap should be 25? One or two? Yeah? I count two. 50? Protection in 50 is a good number? 50 once? 50 twice? 75? 100? 75. Thank you, Susan. So, look. What I'm saying, we got a room of very intelligent people here, and yet we cannot come up with a number. And the reason I want to highlight that is, protection gap is one of those things. If you look about the law of large number, which is our profession, on an individual basis, right? If you think about yourself, what percent if you ever experienced a natural event in your life, your house and content, like whether you lost things, you were never lost, and you had a car accident, you never had a car accident, like what is the protection gap on your own individual? You have access. I personally put my deductibles, touch wood, and never need to use it, to 2,000, the maximum I can, so I save the premium, right? So, but also there are things that I want to insure my house that I deliberately drop the sum insured so I don't want to pay the premium. So like there are things that insure, there are things that are not insured. So there is a protection gap on the individual level. And some of that is risk appetite. Sometimes that is risk tolerance. Sometimes it's... And if you apply the law of large number, putting society as a collection of individuals, that protection gap is really a reflection of individual behavior. So... yes, there is a bit about affordability, there is a bit about accessibility and availability, but also there's a bit about personal choice. So when you look at societies as a whole, you know, you've gone back to the Maslow triangle kind of thing, right? I tend to think for certain things, for certain line of business, because you know, when you look at the protection gap, you've got to separate man-made and NatCat, is for certain line of business, you would argue a higher protection gap, it's acceptable. But others are not. So I don't think I will answer the question, but what I want to highlight is not a black and white, say we're going to put a number here. We can't even put a range there because it needs to put a society lens on it. But then you can't say the whole of Australia, 35% protection gap in the whole of Australia sounds about right because it doesn't. Because when it comes to New South Wales, Northern Territories, it's not. When you come to different individual communities, it's not. So it has to be applied by different level of society structures.
Thanks. So I guess moving on, next questions move on to the roles of government. So for a very specific question on what is the appetite of Australian, I guess federal or state governments in particular, for sophisticated reinsurance arrangements? And then following on from that, how do you assess that globally, based on the slide of all the lots of examples of where that has happened in other areas?
Yes. So I'm going to dig my own grave now. First of all, we attended, and so does our colleagues in the industry, we attended the commissioned inquiry on the 2022. Flood inquiry, right? So it wasn't a pleasant experience, but we all did it. So I think, from that point of view, you know, government's role. What I want to highlight that my personal observation is government is looking into this. And if you're in the industry, if you're practicing, it almost feels like everyone is talking about it, because every second day you bump into a conversation that sounds so familiar. It's like, I had this conversation with another agency last week, but I can't tell you who it is because of all these confidentials. And then you bump into another one. I had two conversations this week. So I think there's a lot of interested parties started to look into this, but there's yet another single entity saying, right, this is our job and everybody listen to us. Because once you start doing that, people can call it, that's dictatorship. You can't do that. So it's a challenging topic, because theoretically government are better placed because it has all the resources in terms of visibility of your risk. I mean, I asked the question: do you or should you have a country risk officer? Right, you got chief risk officer in corporates. You got chief risk officer in some government agencies, but we don't really have a chief country officer to look at the country risk. Maybe we do, we just don't know about them. When you look at the globally speaking on that chart, you realize a lot of the innovation, a lot of the government response coming from developing country, where I think it's one of those things when it obviously depends on the social structure, depends on the political system, which I'm not going to touch on at all. But if you look at some of these developing countries, when they're desperate need, people do desperate things in desperate times, right? When you're desperate need for protections, then things tend to move faster, people are more aligned. When time sometimes is not always good, when you have a bit more time, or you think you have a bit more time, people say, you know what, let's sit down and discuss and investigate the perfect solution and what is the best way to make everybody happy. The reality is you can't make everybody happy, and the reality is you're going to start somewhere with the risk of not making it right. So going back to the question, is government in a better place to handle these kind of things? I think definitely yes, and I also see the efforts, and I see the recent challenge. There's a lot of controversy about ARPC, and the view diverged completely. But then at least it's an attempt, right? So it's not perfect, it's not necessarily right, but it's an attempt. And globally, we have other more developed country having pooled solutions, and developing country, you've got the Turkish pool, you know, we've got the Flutri. So it is a common theme. And from my public sector engagement point of view, our colleagues globally are all having similar conversation. If you simply just measure by the pin, like the number of conversation you have about pooled solution, that trend is definitely increasing.
Great, thanks. Then a specific question on the Totara cap on structure. Yep. So it's a question whether the coupon only is at risk in that structure, or the principal and coupon?
It's the principal and coupon. It's no different. It's fully characterized. It's indemnity based. It's no different from a claims coverage point of view. It's no difference from your traditional insurance or reinsurance. It's just the source of capital is from a different group of people who are not actually trading insurance risk. They're not really investing in your underwriting capability. It's like, if I'm a shareholder of Swiss Re, I invest in Swiss Re's underwriting system, underwriting judgment, in your global expertise in certain things. But when people invest in cat bond, I would say all of them, but the majority of them is investing for a different reason. It's either for the diversification of your financial market, because of that cat, and it's a different way of accessing some of the natural catastrophe risks.
So I believe it's typical that the coupon and principal would be at risk in an ILS structure, but it's not typical that it would be indemnity-based, as
correct,
that one is. And so that leads to a little bit of a leading question around, do you think there are barriers that could be amended to the ability to issue ILS or parametric cover in Australia in particular?
Yes, there's definitely barrier, but I think the barrier is in the mind, not in the action. So that when I say that, is typically I had conversations. I don't want to name names, but you say, I can't do this because if I've got any APRA colleagues here, it's like APRA doesn't allow me to do it, right? So it has been said. I'm not entirely agree with it. I don't agree with that at all. But you know, APRA had certain rules about what you can do, what you can't do. But they also says if you do things in a certain way, you just have to make sure you have capital, right? So it's a conversation about capital. Now, with that mindset, If your intention is not about capital protection, then there's no barrier for you to transact parametric or LLS related transactions, because you're buying that for a different purpose. And this is why, from what my observation is, the conversation about LLS parametric is more profound and progressive in the government setting or some of the large corporate, because some of the time when they enter in this kind of discussions, it's not about capital. It's about emergency release, right? When government enter into a parametric cover is after a disaster, I can get this much money readily available within a week, and I can start distributing this and using this on recovery, rather than sitting there and waiting for loss adjusters to come in and go through things and deciding contribution of negligence, et cetera. So the motivation of buying LLS and cat bond is, if the motivation of buying those is different, then there's no barrier. If you want the motivation is used as a form of capital, I haven't done capital modeling for a long time, I'm not qualified to say that, but I will say that may lead to a very different outcome. Because it may not be as capital efficient as the other standard or traditional coverage. And also, what I want to expand on that one thing is, it's not cheaper either. Right? So, because end of the day, you're doing the same amount of risk transfer. You look at the same loss, same model. If you really want to remove, I guess it is cheaper from a point of view. It can be cheaper, but it also means you're going to have a basis risk you're going to bear. Right. And the question is, how? And this is the question about risk appetite and risk tolerance. How do you have the appetite to bear the basis risk? And once you may or may not, but you also have to consider, do you have the tolerance to bear the risk? Right? Because the basis risk, there may be a basis risk you don't like, but the basis risk may be you can tolerate.
Okay, so I'd ask you all to thank Bo again for covering a lot of territory.
Thank you very much.